Thousands upon thousands of Americans lost their homes during the economic crisis of 2008 and 2009, commonly known as the housing bubble. One of the primary reasons why this happened was because of something called subprime loans. Mortgage loans were made to people who simply shouldn't have qualified for them. The reason banks do this is simply greed. They hope they can gouge consumers and keep losses in check. But then what happens when the economy slows at the same time? What happens when people just can no longer make the payments? The result is that the entire system falls apart, and that's exactly what happened in 2008. I'm John Kiriakou. Welcome to The Whistleblowers. The housing bubble economic collapse of 2008 and 2009 was the worst period of economic decline since the Great Depression. Indeed, it's called by many the Great Recession. Memoirs by former Fed chairmen and secretaries of the Treasury are clear. Economic, business, and banking leaders had no idea how to get themselves out of a crisis caused by greed and with money being too readily available. That greed was simply providing loans to people who shouldn't have qualified for them and who had no way to pay them back. At the first sign of economic trouble, as the economy slowed and unemployment went up, people suddenly fell behind on their payments. Hundreds of thousands just walked away from their homes, turned the keys over to the banks, and watched as everything fell apart. But none of this should have come as a surprise. There was ample warning that a disaster was approaching. Our next guest was one of the people who was warning his leaders about the danger. As a chief business underwriter for Citigroup during the housing bubble and the subsequent financial crisis, Richard Bowen repeatedly warned executive management and the bank's board of directors as many as 60% of prime mortgages were a risk. He also warned about the risks associated with Citi's practice of lowering its standards for subprime mortgages. His warnings were ignored. And as if that wasn't bad enough, Citi stripped him of all responsibilities, placed him on administrative leave, and told him that his presence at the bank was no longer required. But everything Richard said turned out to be true. He later testified before the Securities and Exchange Commission, and he gave nationally televised testimony before the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. Richard's experience was covered by the renowned news program 60 Minutes, as well as by the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, and the Washington Post, as well as other major outlets. Richard, thank you so much for joining us. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, John. It's a pleasure to meet you as well as be on your show.
Thank you, sir. The pleasure is all mine. Richard, for so many Americans, the housing bubble hit like a ton of bricks with no warning. But that really wasn't the case. There actually were indications that something terrible was going to happen. When did you first see something was amiss? And what did you do at the very beginning?
Well, in 2006, Citigroup was the largest bank in the world. And in early 2006, they consolidated all of their banking operations, very diverse banking operations. And they consolidated these, and I received a huge promotion. I was promoted to business chief underwriter. I had responsibility to make sure that the $90 billion a year of mortgages that Citigroup was purchasing from other banks and mortgage companies. Now, understand, Citigroup did not make these mortgages. They did not originate them. They purchased them from other banks and mortgage companies. Mm-hmm. And when they purchased these, they would turn around and they would sell them. They would sell them to Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, mortgage securitizations. And when they sold them, they would give their guarantees. They would give their representations and warranties that these mortgages met their policy guidelines. Well, I took over my new responsibilities in early 2006. And by June of 2006, and again, it's my responsibility to make sure that these met our policy guidelines. Mm-hmm. Well, in June of 2006, I discovered that over 60% of these mortgages did not meet our guidelines. Wow. they were by definition defective. Many of them were fraudulent. Wow. And silly me, I thought it was my job because they were selling them and guaranteeing that they were good mortgages. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I started issuing warnings. I sent email. I put it in my weekly report. I made committee presentations. I cornered people in the hallways, at the water fountain. I'm not a shy guy. And through 2006 and 2007, the volumes kept increasing, and the rates of defective mortgages increased from 62 in excess of 80%.
Oh, my gosh.
And yet nothing would happen. They continued to sell them and guaranteed to the purchasers that they met our guidelines. So I knew somehow this had gone up very high in the organization. I knew somehow I had to get to the board of directors. But how do you do that? And I was agonizing over this when on November the 2nd of 2007, it hit all of the press that they were calling an emergency board meeting for that coming Sunday, November the 4th. And it was in the press that Charles Prince was going to resign at that board meeting as chairman, and Robert Rubin was going to be named chairman of the board. Mm-hmm. That's mm-hmm. it. Yep. That's how I get my warnings to the board meeting. So the next day, on Saturday, November the 3rd, sitting at my kitchen table, I put together an email. I addressed it to Robert Rubin, who was named chairman of the board the next day. I also sent it to the major executives, the chief auditor, the chief financial officer, the chief risk officer. And I told them the story about how I'd been issuing warnings for a year and a half.
Wow.
And because I knew under Sarbanes-Oxley, I knew they were legally bound to tell the board and tell investors that there was this fraudulent activity going on. Mm-hmm. Well, John, I got their attention all right. I subsequently told not to come back to the bank. And this was not a fun time in my life.
No, I imagine not. Going back to that period, you were clearly a detail person. You were looking at the numbers, the charts, the graphs, the complicated data related not just to the economy, of course, but to the bank's holdings and loans. You saw this troubling pattern. You went to the bank's executives about it. And the reaction then was, well, at the beginning, to just ignore you. Why is it that they chose to ignore you? Because obviously they have access to the same kind of information that you had. You were the one who was supposed to be sort of the analyst for them. So why did they just dismiss you?
And no one could argue with what I was saying. Mm-hmm. They just, well, these are just technical exceptions. You know, there's no reason that this is going to, you know, we're going to have losses on this. And of course, this was while the bubble was still expanding. Mm-hmm. And we didn't yet have those losses. And I said, okay, if it's simply a policy issue, it's technically against the policy, then change the policy. Well, they couldn't do that. Mm-hmm. But the real reason, in hindsight, John, is this was a very profitable business model of buying defective mortgages and selling them. And by the way, this wasn't just with Citigroup. This was with other mortgages. Other mortgage companies were doing this too on a very widespread basis. And this was throwing off tremendous amounts of incentive compensation that went into all of the managers' pockets. So if they were going to take any action on what I was yelling about, they would have had to have changed and mm-hmm. shut down this very profitable business model. And of course, you know, that would have personally been pretty onerous to some of the executives involved. So they chose to continue collecting the money and ignore me. But I wasn't through with Citi.
Well, I'm curious when things began to turn for you personally. You were providing information based on years of experience and analysis of the data that could potentially have saved Citigroup billions of dollars. But as often happens with whistleblowers, you were silenced. You were essentially suspended and thrown out. At what point did that happen? When Citigroup turned on you, were things already going down the drain economically, or was this still at the height of the bubble, as you said?
This was still really at the height of the bubble.
Wow.
It had not completely turned yet. It was starting to. And, if anyone paid any attention to what I was talking about, you know, the numbers were climbing, the delinquencies, the first payment defaults, they were going up. Again, it hadn't fully hit yet, but there was no doubt where this was going, at least.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about your mindset at the time. You had been paid to do a job to advise the bank based on the economic data. You had done exactly that. You were first ignored and then actively punished. When did you decide, all right, I've had enough, I'm gonna go to the authorities? And this is really for my own edification. Did you consider yourself to be a whistleblower at the time?
No.
Yeah.
No, I didn't.
No whistleblower does.
It was obvious this was going to blow up. It was my responsibility. I took this very personally, that I needed to warn them. I mean, that was my job. I was a business chief underwriter. After they had thrown me out, I wound up, this has got to be stopped before it, you know, really causes havoc in the economy. And that's when I went, I testified for 2 days.
Wow.
Before the SEC in Washington. I actually gave them, and this was in July of 2008, I actually gave them 1,000 pages of documents showing the massive fraud that was going on within Citigroup. And these young prosecutors in their enforcement division, they got really excited.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, Bowen, we are going to pursue this. And then 3 months later, I never heard anything from them. 3 months later was when Citigroup was bailed out in three separate bailouts, where they received close to $500 billion in capital and toxic asset guarantees. Plus, they received another $2.5 trillion of secret low-interest loans from the Federal Reserve. We never found out about that until years later. At the end of the bailouts, the United States government took ownership. Now, they did not nationalize it, but they took ownership of 36% of the world's largest bank. And the SEC has refused, they've locked up my testimony. They won't release it. And there've been many requests under the Freedom of Information Act to release some of the, you know, testimony that I gave them. And they have totally refused, saying that the documents are confidential and trade secrets. So I guess that includes the fraudulent representations which were given to the purchasers of mortgage-backed securities, which I off the SEC's own public website where the securities were registered.
Richard, please stay with us. We're speaking to Citigroup whistleblower Richard Bowen about his actions during the economic crisis of 2008 and 2009. Stay tuned. We have a lot more to come.
тут сплю, обуваюсь, іду гуляти, кушаю, іграюсь.
Взрыв огромный был, когда я шел на танцы в Донецк.
А вы почему свою дочь прятали?
Ну, чтобы не вывезли насильно.
Ну, вообще, это украинские волонтеры. Они могли насильно вывозить детей.
Я не знаю, где мои родные родители. Я их уже давно не видел.
Я уехала, потому что хотела спасти детей.
Ты не знаешь, останешься ты живой, либо не останешься.
Take a fresh look around at life. Kaleidoscopic, isn't it? A shattered reality distorted by power. Tired vision with no real opinions. Pictures designed to simplify or confuse. Who really wants a better world? And is it just for the chosen few? Fractured images presented as fact. Can you see through their illusions? Going Underground can.
あんな悲惨なな悪魔の法則のようなことをもう忘れようと思って一緒になってる。
Unit 731 was a unique organization in the history of the world. What they were trying to do was to simply do nothing short than build the most powerful and most deadly biological weapons program that the world had ever known.
それを各班にな作らして、それで最前線をしょったわけよ。取れたでな、その一回金を作るのに3人ぐらい殺しよったんや。
一般の丸太、木の丸太ですね。人間とも思わなかったんではないかと思いますよ。
赤ちゃんのな入った女の人を解剖してな、赤ちゃんを標本に入れるんだ。お母さんも殺してな。
14歳の子供ですからね、まだやっぱり病気にかかった人、怪我をした人、こういった人の治療をやったりすると思ってたんです。ところがしまいにはね、細菌戦の専門技術員だろうというようなことが出てきましたけれども。
Welcome back to The Whistleblowers. I'm John Kiriakou. We're speaking with Citigroup whistleblower Richard Bowen, who tried repeatedly to warn the bank bad prime and subprime mortgage loans could sink the company as the economy began to slow. He was ignored and then punished for his revelations, even though he did it in exactly the way that he was supposed to do it. Richard, thanks again for being with us.
Thank you, John.
Richard, I'm curious as to how far the company went to punish you for your revelations. It seems that so many big companies, as well as government agencies, simply don't care that we have whistleblower protection laws in the United States. The revelations you made should have been protected by law. So what happened once the company lashed out at you? I know that you eventually went to the Government Accountability Project, one of the most important whistleblower groups in the United States. Is that when it happened?
Well, I did not originally go to the Government Accountability Project. I'm very sorry that I didn't. I wasn't aware of them at the beginning. Mm-hmm. I started out with two separate attorneys. And this is one thing I caution everyone about is get good legal representation. My attorneys very quickly figured out which side of the bread the butter was on, and it was not my side. And then I was later introduced to the Government Accountability Project, which I know you're familiar with.
Oh, yes.
And they absolutely wonderful. When they took over with their muscle and they started guiding me through this, quite frankly, that's one of the reasons I think I survived the ordeal, is because I had the Government Accountability Project on my back. And they, with their legal prowess, they protected me.
They and really are guided a great me. Group of people.
Yes.
Yeah, they are. Tell us more about your testimony before the Securities and Exchange Commission, and then later the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. At what point in your whistleblowing did that happen? And what was the reaction from your former bosses and colleagues at Citigroup?
Well, understand, I was already gone when I was thrown out, I guess this was in early 2008, and I really had no interaction with the with my former colleagues. And quite frankly, they were very cautious of interacting with me also, because I obviously had quite a stigma with the bank. But you were talking about the SEC. You know, if you think about it, you can sort of understand what the SEC was doing. And this is a sad observation, but if they ever did release any of the 1,000 pages of documents that I gave to them, then they would basically have to admit that the United States government had full knowledge of the massive fraud that was going on within Citigroup before they bailed them out.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And that's why they have continued to cover this up today, in spite of many requests under the Freedom of Information Act. They still will not release any of those documents.
Richard, psychologists who study whistleblowers have concluded that they have a very highly defined sense of right and wrong, far more highly defined than the general population. But at the same time, people who blow the whistle on wrongdoing almost never make a financial comeback. How have you fared in the 14 years since you blew the whistle at Citi?
Well, I will tell you, I became a professor of accounting at the University of Texas at Dallas. And I attribute that to my sanity, to be able to work with these young people. And I am a CPA, I have an accounting background. And to be able to work with these young people and try to prepare them to at least be conscious and aware when they join corporate cultures. So that is really, now I recently retired from the university and I still speak on the subject, on ethics. But, you know, my being able to be a professor actually was a haven and helped me as I finished up. As a matter of fact, when I went to the SEC, and when I ultimately testified, and we haven't talked about this yet, before the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, I was a professor at the University of Texas at Dallas.
Excellent. And what was their reaction like? Because, you know, it's so often that that really any large organization, including universities, are risk averse. And here they've got a professor who is in the news. He's testifying before the Securities and Exchange Committee, or Commission rather, on something that's arguably the biggest economic story of the last 75 years. They were okay with that? They treated you well?
Understand, I never told the university. I did tell a few key people that I was testifying before the SEC. The only time it was widely known that I had testified was after I had testified before the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission and received all the publicity that went along with that. So the school has been very, very supportive. The dean of the School of Management has been aware of everything that has gone on, and he has He has supported me as well as the rest of the school administration. And then since then, it's been exceptionally rewarding. It truly has been.
I want to tell you about an experience that I had with the Securities and Exchange Commission, and I want to get your reaction to it. I was the chief investigator on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee from 2009 to 2011, and there was a large-scale Ponzi scheme that had taken in thousands of Americans for billions of dollars. And so the SEC was supposedly investigating this thing. I wanted to at least begin an inquiry up on Capitol Hill. And so I went to the SEC for a previously scheduled meeting. They wouldn't let me in. Now, I had scheduled the meeting in advance. I had transferred my security clearance to the SEC just so that there wouldn't be a problem. But they would only meet me in the lobby of the building. And then after the meeting was over and I went back to my office in the Senate, they emailed me and asked very politely if I would please drop my inquiry. I wouldn't, and they went over my head, and they called the chairman of the committee, who was Senator John Kerry at the time, my boss, and he forced me to drop the inquiry. What was the reception like for you at the SEC? Because the reason I ask this is the SEC is supposed to be the good guys here. This is what they're in the position to do, to investigate these kinds of allegations. It sounds like you had not such a great experience. I certainly had not such a great experience, but I'd like to hear your side of it.
Now, again, from my side of it, they were initially, they had tremendous initial enthusiasm. Again, these investigators, some of these were prosecutors in their enforcement division. They got very excited when I was talking to them and going through the evidence that mm-hmm. I was giving them.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
it was only later, a very short while later, that obviously they received word from on high that they were to drop this and cover it up. That's the only explanation.
So really, your testimony was never made public?
No.
Then or subsequently?
No, they have refused continuously to release any of the 1,000 pages of documents that I gave to them. And there's been a number of publications. The New York Times actually investigated everything that happened. And in September of 2013, they actually wrote a full-page op-ed in their Sunday edition explaining what had happened to Richard Bowen and how he had been muzzled and whistleblowing, not only at the SEC, but also at the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission.
I would like to thank our guest, Richard Bowen, for joining us, and thank you to our viewers for tuning in. There are very few people or companies who are publicly opposed to whistleblowing. After all, whistleblowing is always in the public interest, but support for whistleblowers is usually the exception rather than the rule. The Economist magazine said many years ago, whistleblowing is good for society but bad for careers. It should be good for both. That's where we come in. Evidence of waste, fraud, abuse, or illegality should be shouted from the rooftops, just like Richard Bowen did. We're right, they're wrong, let's keep it up. I'm John Kiriakou, and you've been watching The Whistleblowers. Until next time.